Blind Nil Audio.
Greetings, Carl here. Today on 50 Fires, you're going to hear my favorite guest ever. It was my wife, Corey. And I was so excited to have Corey on because I talk with Corey about money more than anybody else. And we've had a long, difficult journey when it comes to our own conversations with money. And she's been my best friend and my partner in these conversations. So I'm so excited for you to hear them. And to be honest, I was a little nervous. And I know she was. She tried to cancel twice, actually. And part of the reason is because she has friends that listen to it, our neighbors that will listen to it. Our moms will probably hear it. Our kids will certainly hear it. And she wasn't sure, and you're going to hear a bit of this in the conversation, she wasn't sure that she had anything valuable to add, which I think you'll agree after listening is the furthest thing from the truth. So one of the concessions I had to make, and I'm just stating this publicly, was I had to agree that my wife could call BS on anything I said during the episode. And you might even hear her do that. And in fact, the negotiation got so intense that I had to agree that she could call BS publicly on anything I said in the future as well. So that's my concession. This episode cost me a lot. I'm Carl Richards, an author, artist, and proud financial planner. And I'm happy to say that even after this conversation, I'm still the husband to my amazing wife, Corey. And today, Corey and I talk about money together on 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning. I'm actually quite curious, before we dive in to the questions, I asked you to do this conversation about money for 50 Fires a couple of times, and there was a bit of resistance at first. So what was the resistance about?
Great first question. Way to ease me into it. No nerves there, right?
For sure.
I guess there was two things. One, I wanted to make sure I had something that felt valuable to share. Mm. And two, it feels like it's your world. And I wasn't so comfortable in that world. And I wasn't so sure I wanted to share. It just feels very personal and intimate how we manage our conversations around money. I wasn't sure I wanted to share that with everybody.
Yeah. Over the years, talking about money hasn't always been the easiest for us.
That is true.
Were you concerned about that? Like, look, this isn't, actually, I'm not sure how good we are at this. Like, was a piece of that playing a role?
Sure. Because if we've had in the past the disagreements around money, which we clearly have.
Yeah.
Do I really want to share that with the world? Not so much. It feels like that's something you do in your closet and then you leave it behind, right? You don't share it with everybody else. So yeah, it's a little uncomfortable.
You don't remember, we've been sharing it for a long time. I remember we would have conversations about money, and we'd have like a fight about money, and you would say, is this going to be in your New York Times column? And I would say, or I remember you saying, is this on or off the record? And I remember saying, you'll have to wait till Thursday when the column comes out to find out.
That is true. I guess that's part of living with you, the man that speaks in public.
The man that pretends to know what he's talking about when it comes to money.
Exactly. It's all good.
Yeah, well, I'm sure hopefully we'll get into more of that, but it's so interesting to me. A couple of months ago, when we started recording some of the early pilots of 50 Fires, I realized there were a whole bunch of these questions that I'm super interested in that I hadn't ever asked you, which is fascinating. We've been married how many years?
28.
See, I wanted to make sure I didn't get it wrong. 28 years, and there's so many of these questions that I haven't asked. So what if we just sort of start at the beginning? And I'm honestly, like, it's going to be, I'll try to call out questions that I may ask you that I already know the answer to. I'm not particularly interested in asking questions I know the answer to. So most of these, it's fascinating to me. I don't know. Like, we haven't had these conversations, which is really, really wild.
Well, do I get to ask you questions back?
Yeah, this is meant to be a conversation. So
awesome.
And what's interesting about this is I feel a little bit like I'm walking without a tightrope here. And so it'll be really easy to empathize with, imagine another couple on a long road trip listening to this and hitting pause and saying, hey, like, we've never talked about this. So like, this is, I don't know if a model is the right word, but let's try, let's see what happens. So okay. Let's back way up to, what is your earliest memory of money?
This is kind of a funny one, but it's actually the tooth fairy, because that was the first time I received money. That was my own. And I was told that money is dirty, like physically dirty, carries a lot of germs. So my tooth fairy boiled the money before it went under the pillow.
Wait a sec. I mean, like, so we have four kids, just for those of you listening. All of our kids would tell you immediately that, like, you don't bring change in the house.
No way.
I didn't know this is where it came from.
Yeah. Because can you imagine something that's really dirty gets put underneath your pillow where you sleep? That's disgusting, right?
Wait, who told you? Because I know all of this. I know that, like, we don't bring money in the house. The kids aren't allowed to, like, I know all of this. But I didn't know there was an origin story. So the origin story, who told you that?
Well, my mom, because she was...
She had communication with the tooth fairy.
Right, yeah. So if I wrote the letter to the tooth fairy, she let me know. But then we progressed from quarters to dollar bills, and she would go and get the brand new dollar bills from the bank and just tear off one, so it's super crisp and clean. And then from there on out, I got paid an allowance and by the tooth fairy in only brand new dollar bills from the bank.
Well, tell me more about what money was like growing up.
Well, my dad was a home builder, so his income definitely ebbed and flowed with the market. So there would be money, and then there'd be no money. And then the housing market would change in Utah, and he'd have to go work in another state. And so it was never consistent. You knew how much was coming home every month. So the word, if I had to pick one word around money from growing up, it was stress. It was stressful. We didn't know. It was always like, maybe there'll be money, maybe there won't. And I actually think I told you that when we first were getting married, like, hey, it's okay if you're an entrepreneur because I know how to deal with that. But the truth is, it's a different level when you're your partner versus your parents.
Yeah.
So if I'm thinking of like a memory with my parents and money, I remember we did a family trip to Canada. We rented an RV. I was quite young. I remember we get all the way to Lake Louise, and my mom had been purchasing food along the way at grocery stores. And so we've been eating, you know, whatever you get out of the little fridge, little sandwiches. And my dad, we get there and he wanted to go and have a nice meal at the restaurant. And my mom got really mad because we weren't spending money. We'd already purchased food. So it was always, there was a contention around, are we spending it? Are we not?
Wow.
Yeah.
It's so interesting to me because I have literally told the story probably hundreds of times.
Yeah.
That you and I grew up 2 miles, like we went to high school probably three miles apart.
Yeah.
And from all outward appearances, we're part of the same socioeconomic class from all outward appearances. But that my parents were divorced when I was 8. Money was super scarce. It was scary. Was there ever going to be enough? My mom was trying to make ends meet, like that. And the story I always tell is that my wife, in her family, her dad was a home builder and money came and went. And if it went, it was no big deal. And if it came, it was no big deal. It was no big deal. Like, it's just all fine. So it's full on abundance mentality. So I was always like, I'm coming from a super scarce mentality. Mm-hmm. My wife, abundance, it comes and goes. And I told you that a month or two ago, and you're like, that's not true at all.
Yeah, it's not. I still would say, I don't believe that narrative has ever really changed of abundance or scarcity. It was always stressful and scarcity. Never enough. I mean, my mom has plenty of money for the number of years she'll live, and she still doesn't spend it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's more of a scarcity idea.
Hey, it's Carl. This is crazy to me because we've been married 28 years. And I mean it when I say I've told that story about my wife's view of money being easy come, easy go, abundance, and mine being scarcity. I have told that story hundreds of times. You can even hear me starting to use my stage voice as I was talking to Corey about it. Like, I've told it so many times. And to find out that that's not true after 28 years and hundreds of times telling that story. So the thing that it made me think of was, what else isn't true? Like, what other assumptions have I made about the way the people closest to me feel or think about money? Like, I'm so excited to have some of these conversations with my kids who are all older, because I realize, like, I have probably made a bunch of assumptions about what they've learned from Corey and I about money, or what we communicated about money, or how they feel about money. I bet I'm wrong about those assumptions. So I'm now taking this approach of, like, I bet I'm wrong. What could I learn? Because that's fascinating. I was shocked at how often this happened in my prior life as a financial planner. Couples who had been married for 5, 10, 15, 20, sometimes 30 years, learning something about each other for the first time about money, because we just never talked about it. It just never came up. It's not, we didn't even have the language to have that conversation. That's amazing. I wonder how I got that so wrong. My impression of your experience with money was wrong.
I would say it was just the house I was living in when you met me seemed as if there was no problem with money, right? It was a nice house. It was slightly up the hill from where you lived. So I think it was just the perception of abundance, which isn't an interesting, the perception is always different than what's going on inside a house.
I was so scared. The first time I came to pick you up on a date, I just remember being like, what am I doing in this neighborhood? Even though it was only like a mile away, right? Like, it wasn't a big deal.
Oh, well, that's what I liked about you. You were from the wrong side of the tracks.
That's exactly. Yeah, really rough neighborhood. Those of you who knew, if you know much about Salt Lake, you would find that really funny. Salt Lake City, Utah does not have very many rough neighborhoods. And the one that I lived in was not rough. So,
it was not rough.
But I just remember being so nervous about all that. Let's talk a little bit about do you remember your parents talking specifically about money, or did you just remember the feeling?
I don't know why, but the memories I have around money are associated with vacations with my parents. So I don't remember having conversations around money when we were at home, but on vacation, it was always a little stressful. Like, should we leave 2 days early because now it's costing too much? Or we'll stay at grandma's house because we don't want to spend money on the hotel, or we're not going to go out to eat. We'll get the sandwiches at the grocery store. So I just remember the idea of, like, we weren't meant to spend it, but I didn't really hear budgeting conversations or anything like that. Well, actually, you know what? I do have one. My first car. My dad gave me an exact amount that I could buy with a car. So it was my job to go find the car. So I went out, I found a Subaru Outback, little small one, used. I was so excited, had the right color, it was in good condition. So I brought my dad down and he's like, well, that doesn't fit in the budget. And I can't, and let's pretend like a $7,000, I think it was, because there was taxes. And I was like, oh, but don't you understand, Dad? I worked hard, I figured it out, we're fine. In the end, he bought the car, but I was mad at him because he wanted it to be exact. And I was like, close enough.
Yeah. Was that the same, that silver colored Subaru?
Yeah. Same one when we got married.
Yeah. I remember being impressed by that Subaru. That was pretty.
Thanks.
Impressed.
I worked hard to find it. Yeah. It's a good used car, huh?
For sure.
Yeah.
Do you remember at school? Like, do you remember what socioeconomic class you belonged to at school?
Well, we moved when I was 12. So the house that you met me in was not the house, you know, the first few years. So at 12, when we moved to that house, it was the nice house. It was the two-story Tudor house in the neighborhood with the doctors and lawyers. And I think I went from not knowing to all of a sudden knowing that we didn't quite have the same amount as the rest of the neighbors. And I actually was thinking about this, you know, when we moved in, there weren't curtains, there wasn't furniture, but I was 12. Like, it was great. It was like a total adventure. I was thrilled to have so much space that you could run around and do the things. And I remember my mom being super uncomfortable that there wasn't all the things to finish the house to feel like you fit in. So I've actually wondered about that. Like, what's the message we're giving to our kids when they don't even know?
Yeah.
to me at 12, there was no reason to think I didn't have as much as the neighbor next door. I didn't know what that even equaled. It was my parents' message that we didn't have enough compared to the neighbors. And so then I think, okay, well, what am I saying to our kids that makes them feel like there's not enough when they maybe aren't even considering whether or not there's enough?
What are you saying to your kids?
You're going to remember this story. So do you remember when our friends were over for dinner? We had one child, I think. And one of our friends, they were back east. He was in graduate school. And she says, oh, that's not in the budget. I think it was for a new car. They had a minivan.
It's a minivan. Yeah, they wanted a new minivan.
They had, yeah. And she said, it's not in the budget. And so that became like the token quote of like a hero quote. Like if you could say the words not in the budget, that was like so cool. So that was perpetuated. But I've been wondering about that. Like, is that actually a good statement? Not in the budget. What's not?
Yeah, well, let's talk about it for a minute, because that was really impactful for me. I remember because there was no conversation about money in my house growing up, period. Like we just didn't, I mean, it just didn't ever come up. I think it was my parents' attempt to maybe like not make that part of our life, like shield us from that, whatever. And I remember so this couple that was at dinner with us, they were, you know, like she was a cheerleader when I think she was a senior when I was a freshman, maybe. And he had gone off to a really impressive job and went to a really impressive business school. And like, these were like, you know, people I looked up to.
Yeah.
And I thought had it all together. And I remember when they said, yeah, we'd like to buy a new car, but it's just not in the budget. I remember feeling like they had broken a rule. Mm. Like the rest of us were playing a game. Like, hey, we've all agreed to just pretend like we can do whatever we want. You don't say to your friends, I can't afford that. I mean, maybe you don't buy it because you're responsible, but you don't say it out loud. I mean, look, we're all playing a game. You've now broken the game. And I remember thinking, what does it even mean not in the budget? Does that mean like the banks won't lend you money? Does it mean you can't afford the payment? Does it mean it won't go on the credit card? Does it mean you don't have cash? Like, what does it mean when you say not in the budget? So I remember that being, I was actually quite impressed by the idea of talking directly about it. Like, it's not in the budget, rather than like, oh yeah, someday maybe we will. That's what I took away from it. You've now wondered whether or not that's a good, that like you're sending a message the whole time, like, we don't have it, we don't have it, we don't have it.
Yeah, it just became like a hero statement to say it's not in the budget. And I knew that you had that experience. And so that
Why do you say it with that voice? What is that voice? Is that mimicking me? Like, not in the budget, like grumpy?
It's not in the budget. Well, I just remember you were so proud if I'd ever say, oh, that's not in the budget, kids. Like, I had said something great, but then it didn't really matter because then I'd go buy it when you weren't looking. Just kidding. No, I just don't think it's necessarily healthy. Well, I guess that's my question to you. Is it healthy to kids to always hear that's not in the budget because then you're talking about it? Or does that feel like there's not, that you're living in scarcity versus abundance? Or is that helpful?
Yeah.
I don't know
the answer. Maybe I can tell another quick story. We have another set of friends. So husband and wife, the wife inherits a bunch of money and she has two brothers. And the two brothers run off and do things with the money. Like, I'm not judging it at all. I'm just saying they went off and they bought beach houses and surfed and whatever. And that may be great. Like, it's fine. But for whatever reason, our friends were pretty convinced they didn't want their kids to be ruined by money. Mm. They didn't want their kids to be ruined by money. So they decided at the earliest age that when their youngest was, as I recall, like 4 or 5, they would just say, anytime he asked for anything, they would just say, we can't afford that. And this went on till their son was like 16, as I recall. And he came in one night after hearing we can't afford that from age 4. So whatever, 10 or 11 years, he came in one night, like sort of late at night, and he wasn't a very serious kid. So it was unusual when he came in kind of late at night and our friend was watching SportsCenter, as I recall, he turned the TV off. His son says, hey, I've got a question. And he says, go ahead. What's the question? What's on your mind? And he says, hey, Dad, between homeless and Warren Buffett, where are we? And that story has always been really impactful to me because this well-intentioned idea, it's not in the budget, we can't afford that. That's a well-intentioned idea, had generated a suboptimal result. Like the result, the goal was to help your kid feel secure with money. And it turns out my friend's approach had made their kids like not only feel insecure, just have no idea what like what's going on between homeless and Warren Buffett. Like that's a huge gap, right? So they realized that they had been talking, really, they actually hadn't been talking about it. They'd been talking around it. Yeah. And I wonder if that's what you're pointing to is like, it's not in the budget. It's just a like cheap excuse way to get around it.
I think you're probably right. It is like just a phrase of like, and also it's kind of an out, right? Like if you don't want to be bothered buying your kid a new pair of skis, sorry, it's not in the budget. And then you're not, it's no longer in your responsibility court.
Yeah.
It's a longer conversation. That's like,
right.
Why should I do my homework? Because I said so. You know, yeah, it's not really a good answer.
No, I like that. The longer conversation, as soon as you said longer conversation, and I use the word like cheap excuse, it, you know, remember like one kid, two kids, four kids, like whatever the number of kids you have, like you're just, it's at that some point in your life, you're just running around like crazy and the dishes and like the cognitive demands of going, oh, you want to talk about this.
Sure.
Like instead of the cheap excuse of like, we can't afford that or it's not in the budget, let's sit down. I remember actually when our son Sam said we were driving and our next door neighbors had just gotten a new water ski boat. And Sam said something from the back seat. He said something like, oh, the so-and-sos must be rich. They got a new boat. And I remember saying, hey, that's really none of our business. And being so surprised that that was the words that came out of my mouth. Because it was just perpetuating the same idea that like money, sex, politics, and religion.
Yeah.
You know, we don't talk about that. And can you imagine four things that you'd want your kids to talk to you more about? Like money, politics, sex, and religion? Of course. But sometimes we're so cognitively overloaded. We're just like, we can't afford it.
We're overloaded. And it's also a little, can be a little uncomfortable. Like, ooh, I'm not sure your allowance is going to be $10 a week. And yeah, your friend might get 20. Well, that's, you know, and you have to work and do your chores for it, and where they might just get it, it can be uncomfortable because then you feel like maybe I'm not doing it right as a parent and you don't know.
Yeah. Do you remember that ever being uncomfortable for you as a kid? Do you ever remember like at school sort of realizing you didn't, or you had way more money than somebody, or you had way less money than somebody? Mm. You were one of the rich kids or one of the poor kids?
Oh, I always knew that I was in the upper class within my high school, you know, so it was a public high school, but it fed from a nice neighborhood. And I knew that I had the right shoes, if that's a thing, but
well, it was a thing. It was a thing.
Yeah. Like I had the shoes, but not the most expensive shoes. Like I had the entry level cool boots, not the super expensive cool boots. Mm. But you know, I don't really remember that being like a huge problem. Like I don't remember thinking, oh, poor me, I don't have something, unless somebody pointed it out. I felt like I had everything I could need. Mm. And again, I think that's a kid's perception, right? Like I had food, I had clothes, I got to go to school, I got to do sports. It was all there. Yeah. Why did I need more? So I think it's often the adults need to give to the kid. Mm. More than the kids need to have it.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
You know, I always think it's funny, like, why does a parent throw a huge birthday party for their two-year-old? Does the two-year-old care? No, the two-year-old doesn't even know, right? Mm-hmm. It's about the parent.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like the classic, at least, I'm sure it happens everywhere, but like Utah wedding.
Oh, yeah. It's about the parents.
Yeah. And they're... doesn't necessarily have to be anything wrong about that, as long as you're open that that's what it's about.
Sure. And hopefully it can, you can make sure the kids are included in the conversation.
Yeah. We'll be right back with more from 50 Fires. Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I'm having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talking Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talking Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talking Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome back to 50 Fires. Tell me just a little bit about your experience with, you know, either your spiritual or religious upbringing, which I happen to know a lot about, and how that informed your view of money. If it did at all, it may not have.
No, very much did. I think that's a great question. So being a girl in our church, the story that was told to me was I was to get education only as a backup plan. I wasn't meant to earn money. I wasn't meant to handle money. I was pursuing education for one reason, backup. Not because I was intelligent, not because I liked it, not because I could have something to contribute. I was going to get married and said husband would earn the money. And in case he died, because there's no real like in-betweens, right? I needed to have a way to feed my children so we weren't like on the street.
Were you told that?
Yes.
Tell me about that experience of like how it felt or what you remember about it back then. And then I'd be curious what you make of it now.
Yeah. I mean, so we went to what was called Young Women's and your Young Women Leaders. That was the story that was being told to me. But at that point in time, I was so inside that community, I didn't question it. I didn't think like, oh, maybe there is a different way. I was fortunate. My dad was not a part of that church for most of my life. And so he was very encouraging of me to get the education I wanted, encouraging of me to go to college. And I have a degree in finance with two minors. I'm thrilled. But then I wasn't really expected to do something with it, right? So yeah, it was the story that was told to me. But I do think the narrative is changing. Slowly and late, but I think it's starting to change. You know, with our three daughters and son, I hope that the feeling that they're getting is like, no, look, you have these brilliant minds. Let's help you figure out what you want to do with it. Mm-hmm. What do you want to do, not just as a backup plan to have a degree to maybe do something in this world?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's what it was. Well, and I feel like I've personally worked really hard to try to change that narrative for myself and for our kids. Mm-hmm. I really want our daughters to know you can do whatever you want to do. in terms of like, if you want to work, if you don't want to work, if you want to work in medicine, finance, engineering, whatever it is, go do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting that that doesn't have to be, you can hold both of those things true at the same time. Like saying one doesn't diminish the other.
Agreed.
Like if somebody chooses one path, that doesn't mean they're more or less. It just means we have different paths. And what you, if I'm understanding you correctly, that wasn't really even an option for you in terms of what you were told.
No, it wasn't even on the option table. Like, yeah, I worked, but they were, you know, backup plan.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, interestingly enough, that's sort of what happened to my mom, right? Like didn't finish her degree because why would you need to?
Right.
You're married to somebody that's, and then that all falls apart. And so now suddenly you're kind of like struggling to put that back together for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a tough position. And I really think that why it is changing, it also creates a new difficult narrative for women. How do you manage both, right? Are you meant to be a mom? Are you meant to earn? Are you meant to do both? Is there time to do both? I mean, now that I am working.
It is so interesting how that's all. I can't even begin to understand. And I've spent lots of time listening to you talk about it and our daughters talk about it and other women talk about that. Still, I'm pointing to like those were traditional times and those were traditional roles. Yeah. And then as soon as I heard myself say out loud, like, you can work and you can take care. I'm like, oh, that's easy, really easy to say. Especially if there's still this traditional mindset of like, oh, when I get home from work, like I'm really worn out and I'm really burned out because I work really like, and I can't, sometimes we joke about the man flu, right? Like you get a little sniffle and suddenly you have to sleep for 3 days.
Yep. I don't know that I have like the answer.
Yeah.
I do think it's a conversation that is late to the game. I'm glad it's happening. And I think it's a lot of work for a woman that's what they're taught to then. Okay, so I'm going to be a little honest here. Part of why I didn't want to have this conversation with you a few weeks ago was just feeling like I lacked an intelligence in money and could have the ability to bring a wise conversation to the table. I wasn't taught that, you know, I wasn't taught that I had the intelligence to use or earn or manage money. I have struggled with that our whole marriage.
That's why you didn't want to talk about this today.
That is true.
It was because you felt dumb.
That's a harsh word, but yes. Unintellectual, can we call it that?
Sure.
I guess it's the same thing.
How I understand a bit about where that came from historically, but where does that come from the last 10 years? Don't worry, nobody's listening. It's not a problem.
Really?
Yeah.
I think it's just we started the marriage with traditional roles. Hmm. You earned the money. I was at home. Then, you know, our oldest is now 18. When she was about 12. Mm-hmm. We're living in New Zealand, small town. She doesn't really need a lot from me anymore. Maybe 13. I can't remember exactly the age, right? But Sam was old enough to drive. Ruby could walk everywhere. She had a bike. She had her friends. All of a sudden, it's like this idea of like, what's my role? What am I meant to do here now that's adding value in this world? That's a tough one to figure out if your entire value system given to you was inside four walls and the little people in those walls, and they're no longer, you know, they become independent. They're their own human beings. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's almost like you're trying to dig your way out of this hole of this is your one job to, hey, maybe I have more to offer in this world. Not that I'm not diminishing offering as a mom. Love it, value it. Cherish every minute of it. And what else is there that I am capable of doing? Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's interesting to me that the words that start coming up immediately are, what is the value I offer? Value and offer, What value do I have to add? Like, those are all rooted in money. Like, those are all financial terms. Offer.
Right.
Like, what's the offer and value?
Yeah.
And we somehow have oriented. I think that's one thing that was interesting, at least for me, what we learned about in New Zealand. And I don't want to move on from the subject yet, but it just as a tangent, was that life in America, again, I'm not placing any judgment here. Like, I'm happy to, we can talk about that if we want to, but I'm just saying life in America is the organizing function at the center of life in America is money and work for most people. It's money. Like, how do I get more? How do I afford my life insurance? How do I afford my health insurance? How am I going to pay the hospital bill? You know, like, we're orienting around work and money. And because we're oriented around work and money, when you think like, I've got time, I've got space, my kids are, the first thing that comes to mind is like, how do I add value?
For sure.
That's really interesting. And especially when you've been told like, well, your whole value is this thing inside the home. And now that's not taking as much time. It's not any less valuable. It's just not taking as much time.
Sure. So do you think that's better in New Zealand? Well, New Zealand is our our landing spot versus the U.S., how you're orienting around the value that we orient around?
I mean, I always try to avoid distractions that will be, you know, like distract people from the point, but you ask the question and it might be part of the point. Like, yeah, I think it's crazy. It's reality. Because of some massive structural systems, right? As we've moved away from collective, you know, the pension, the job for 30 years, the family structure, the multi-generational family structure, you know, that like mom, grandma moves in, you know, we'll take care of the kids. Like that whole, as we've moved away from that, away from collective systems towards individual systems, 401k, save for yourself, live in autonomous units. And again, you could make an argument that that's good or bad. I don't know. But one of our friends who's traveled a lot and lived overseas a bunch, we stayed in his house in France. I love the comparison he used, which was that every country is like an equalizer, like one of those old fashioned equalizers that you could turn up the bass or the treble or the whatever, whatever, whatever. That if I asked you, like, what's Italy tuned to? Mm. You know, you would say something like, what?
Food.
Yeah, that was the first thing that came to my mind. Food, maybe European football, you know, soccer.
Yeah.
Maybe bike racing, like whatever. If we said New Zealand, what would you say New Zealand's tuned to?
Whānau, their families.
Yeah, family, the beach.
Outside.
Holiday. Like, geez, yeah. Like the number of school holidays. Like,
oh my gosh.
You know what I mean? So, but our friend's point was, his name's Sam. Sam's point was that when you get to America, the volume is so loud that you can't even tell what it's tuned to. And the volume is money. And again, maybe out of a requirement, I'm just saying, do I think that's bad? Yeah. I mean, I think it's crazy that it's the orienting force of our lives.
You know, something I've been thinking about the last little bit here is we've been spending 2 years remodeling our house, getting back to a space where like it's ours. Now we're working on the outside, we're building the decks, we're doing the landscaping just so we can get to the spot of like, it's ours, we can rest. Am I happier with it, right? We have put so much energy into getting this house done. Time's ticking, you know, those 2 years, what else could I have done with those 2 years? Am I going to actually get a spot of like, oh, it's all perfect? No, of course not. But the other night, Sam, I was talking to our son, Sam, and he said, you know, last night I couldn't sleep. And so I was laying there thinking about if I had a genie, what would I want to ask of the genie? So he said, I'm curious, what would you ask of the genie? I was like, my instant answer was enough money that we have finished our house. Everybody's paid and they're all gone. And it's just done. Like, I knew immediately that was my answer. Hmm. And I asked him, like, what was your thought? What would you want from the genie? He's like, finding my purpose. How am I going to help people in this world? I was like, oh, is my answer shallow? You know, so I don't know that I am happier having spent these 2 years, honestly, kind of going through hell to get our house remodeled. compared to like we were renting. And it wasn't my issue to manage in New Zealand. As much as design's my world, right? That's my thing. I love it. And am I happier with the process?
Huh. So interesting. Do you, I mean, because part of your purpose, and I think part of one of the things we've looked forward to together is having people creating space. You've always done this, no matter where we were, whether we were renting or owned, you've always created a space where people would come. That's always been part of the purpose. Do you see a connection there between that work and the house specifically? Because we know, we both know. I mean, we're both clear, like big house, fancy house, none of that stuff matters at all. And I feel like one of the reasons you've gone through, as you put it, hell, the last 2 years, and I don't doubt that having watched it, is this isn't about big and fancy house. This is about soul and craft and a place for people to feel comfortable and safe.
Yeah.
Do you feel that connection?
I guess two thoughts come to mind. First thought is like back to like me being the child at 12, moving in the house, not caring what it looked like. So do when other people come to my house, do they really care? Like, sure, you walk in someone's house, if it's clean, it's nice, there's a place to sit, there's good food, there's good conversation. Do they really care which fabric's on the sofa? Probably not, right? The same as I didn't care as a kid that, did we have the right curtains for the neighborhood? No. But then, yes, putting soul into that house, so it's not just your big box finish. Yes, I do care deeply about that, because then it feels like it's patina and things that I want. I want to create the space where it's comfortable for people to be. I also think the bar is a little high sometimes. People just want to be with good people, have good conversation, eat some good food, you know? Mm-hmm.
The conversation Corey and I just had is something I do with people all the time. And that's trying to connect use of capital with a sense of purpose, right? Because it's one thing to say, big, fancy house. Well, that's actually meaningless to anybody who thinks a big, fancy house is going to make them happy is going to be sorely disappointed. It's an entirely different thing to say, I'm spending this time, Corey pointed to how much time she'd spent on her house, time, money, energy, and attention, the four sources of capital we have, time, money, energy, and attention. I'm spending that in a way that's aligned with a sense of purpose. And the sense of purpose is much deeper than, you know, fancy or something like competitive with somebody else, like better than the neighbors or like the one I saw on Instagram. Like that will never lead to lasting happiness. But what I was trying to uncover here and was really, really interested in Corey's perspective was Corey's use of capital, her time, her money, her energy, and her attention, I believe is deeply linked to something that she sees as a fundamental core aspect of her purpose on the planet, which is creating space for people to feel comfortable. So that link is really important. And it's something we could all go through. And I try to go through it often. Like, am I using my time, money, energy, and attention? Am I using my capital in a way that's aligned with what's actually important to me? Am I using my capital in a way that's aligned with what's actually important to me? Did you know, have I ever told you the story that we had this summer? We had a couple of them, but we had a summer that was like the dream summer in terms of travel. We went all over the world. I know you know that. We went all over the place. I never went anywhere. Like my high school graduation trip, my senior trip was to Mazatlan, Mexico. That was the first time I left the country. It doesn't really quite even count, right? Like I'd never been anywhere. And we went all these places.
Yeah.
And I remember at the end of the summer asking Sam what the highlight was. And I can't remember. I mean, the specific memory I've made up, and I'm not exactly sure, but it was something like, the one I've repeated is, hey, Dad, do you remember that time that we were just skipping rocks in the lake?
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa. What about France? What about Amsterdam? Like, what about whatever, like wherever the places we went? He's like, nah, remember that time we were skipping rocks in the lake?
Yeah.
Like, it's so fascinating to me that and that's not to say travel's bad. It's not to say that at all. I'm just think your point of Like, it's probably simpler than we think.
Well, and the place where you're skipping rocks in the lake, I think, is all of our kids' favorite trip. And it's a 5-hour drive.
Yeah, and we stayed in a pretty basic, rustic sort of accommodation. Sure,
like a rustic cabin. Yeah. So I think that, the happiness piece is more simple than we are giving credit to.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, so beautiful. There's so much to dive into there, but I want to make sure we have time. I mean, we can take as long as we need, but that we still haven't gotten into any like arguments yet, which we've got to get into. Okay, so Corey, it hasn't been exactly easy living with me and money. And there's all sorts of things wrapped up in that, right? Like it's pretty challenging. I have never written anything about being perfect or even good at this thing called money. In fact, most of the time I say like, I'm really bad at it personally. I'm just really good with other people's. Like I'm really good at helping other people make these decisions. But for some reason, even despite those disclaimers, there's this expectation that like, you know, you play the person who talks about money and emotion on, not on the TV, but on the newspaper, you must be really, really good at it. And then I realized like, I'm not exactly the easiest person to deal with for you at home with money. And so there's all this extra shame or blame or feeling like a fraud that we have to also unpack. So in light of all of that, I want to just talk about like how we've dealt with it. And I think the place I want to use to jump into this is an email I'm holding up for those of you who aren't watching, can't see it. This is an email that went out to 50,000 people on my weekly letter. It's the Behavior Gap weekly letter. It's called Talking About Money is Hard, but Imperative. And I said something like, the most difficult subject to talk about, clearly at the top, beating out death, politics, and religion, and sex, selected by 44%, was money. I talked about how hard it was, and I said, hey, before I spend more time on this, would you just hit reply? Do me a 3-second favor, hit reply, say yes or no. Is money hard for you to talk about with your spouse or partner? That was the email. So I skipped a bunch, but that was the request. I got hundreds, if not thousands, of responses. And I read every one. So I'm flipping through them real quick, reading, and I get to one that reads this. The answer is capital yes, ! It is hard because often it feels defensive. She spent too much. He spent too much. Was that aligned with our values? What are our values? How come there isn't more? And if only she would spend less, I wouldn't have to work so hard. So I'm reading that email. I'm like, whoa, wow, that email. And I get to the from. It says from the spouse with a smiley face. I look up at the address and it's your email address. Tell me about this.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think we've gotten a lot better since that email was written. That was a few years ago, right?
Let's see.
When was that?
I went and printed it out. 2018.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's
that recent.
That's
okay.
Hey, that's 6 years.
Oh, your math's not very good. What year is it right now?
Okay, it's 5 years. Fine. It was July. It's just over 5 years. I'm not very good at math either.
Yeah, but that was the experience we were having, right? You're the guy with money, and there was a constant feeling of pressure around our house with the shame of spending too much, and then you had to work too hard, and then you were too tired. And I mean, I think some of the words you used is you felt like you're in like a gerbil wheel, like go, go, go. There was no exit route. And I was feeling like, well, I'm in the gerbil wheel of like, we want to have our kids play sports. We want to go skiing as a family. We want to have our friends over for dinner, and there needs to be a chair for every person to sit on. I was trying to keep up what I thought my expectations were, and you were trying to keep up your expectations. And I think we both were just like trying to put our stake in the ground. It's like, you're not hearing me. This is too much. It's a tough position.
Mm-hmm. What was that like when you say tough? What does tough mean? Because I'm here for you, Corey. You can just let it all out.
Okay, you asked the question, Carl.
I sure did.
Yeah. There was a lot of shame, you know, like the Amazon boxes arrives and what's in that box? How come there's so many boxes? Do you really use all those face products? I'm like, well, yes. Don't you want me to look gorgeous? Do we need that expensive shampoo? I'm like, my hell, it's shampoo. You know,
I still don't understand the need for expensive shampoos.
That's because you don't have any hair. Right. But like, I never see myself as extravagant, but there are certain things that I definitely care about. Do I put my money there? Yes, I do. Would I try to open the Amazon box before you got home, throw the box in the recycle, put the package in the drawer and call it good? So that way then I didn't have to have the conversation every time.
Wow.
Because I didn't want to have to face you looking at me like, really? How much did that cost? And who's paying for it? You know what's my least favorite question from you?
I'm totally excited. No, I don't. Tell me what it is.
Well, I would say, hey, what do you think? Should we do this? And you'd say, where do you think that money's coming from? And I'd be like, I don't know. I don't have insight to your bank account. I only have the insight to my bank account. And they were not that I feel like you were hiding money, but I don't see the business, right? I don't manage the business. I don't know if there's 10,000 or 50,000 or whatever your number is. I only see how much comes in for me to manage every month.
Yeah.
So there was always felt a feeling of disconnect. Like, I meant to manage this. I don't know if there's more over here and how am I meant to manage that? It's a hard spot for me. I'm sure for you too, right?
I'm sure, like, looking back over the years of those conversations, I'm sure that was super hard. Did you really hide the Amazon boxes?
Carl, all the time.
Because I saw a lot of them. So that just means there's like exponentially more than I knew about. Yeah. And just to clarify, it doesn't really matter. But when you say I didn't see your bank account, you were talking about the business.
Sure. Yeah. I didn't think you were hiding any money, but
right.
Yeah.
Right. Outside of the business, we have shared accounts.
But look, you run your own business. Your income goes up and down. It fluctuates. Some months there's more, some months there's less. I never know where that number is. And so then if I'm planning our family to do something, I always think, well, it's no problem. You'll just make some more.
Let's talk about that for just a second, because I think it's really interesting. You've had some really good insight you've helped me a lot. I remember coming home often and saying like, oh no, if this continues, right? Like, you know, you take like the last 2 months of income revenue for the business. I'm like, if this continues, and it had been declining, if this continues, we'll be like, we spent more money this month than we made. I used to say that a lot.
Yeah.
And you really helped me understand something around this. Do you remember the conversation?
I remember having those conversations, but I'm not sure what you're thinking of.
Well, I remember when you said, hey, that's the nature of your business. Like, don't talk to me about spending more or less in a month. Like, could you please show me the last year? And for us, it was largely like 3 years. I mean, it was like,
yeah.
Because, and I, the only reason I wanted to bring this up is there's a lot of people listening to this that have lumpy incomes. You know, it's not, and again, this is reflecting back on the conversation we had about New Zealand and America. A lot of people are dealing with this right now, like lumpy income. Like, I'll make a bunch this month and nothing for 2 months.
Right.
And learning to deal with that, not only just mechanically, like, you know, like we worked together to almost just create a paycheck. Like, we pretend like, okay, here's our paycheck. That mechanically, that's easy. It's the emotional piece of it. Like, what would you say about just the emotional piece of the roller coaster ride of lumpy incomes and conversations that generates?
Exhaustion. It's hard, right? When it's the ever changing, you feel like you're always on the slightly unstable ground, the slightly moving sand of which direction is it going to slide this month, this year. And that's within the box of we've always been okay. Yet it still feels like it's kind of that shifting ground, which I think that uncertainty, it just leaves you feeling a little unmoored, maybe.
Mm-hmm. How have you gotten more comfortable with that?
We outsourced a third person. I think that was one of the smartest things we did, right? Because then it takes the emotion out of it. She's just very logical.
You're talking about our financial planner.
Our financial planner, yeah.
Hey, it's me again. People always find this surprising. And I actually kind of find it surprising that people find it surprising that I have a financial planner. Right? I remember when I first mentioned that, somebody said, like, why do you have a financial planner? And the reason is really simple. Making decisions about money is not a function of skill. It's often a function of behavior. And so much of our behavior happens in what are called blind spots. And this is going to be the most profound thing you hear on this entire episode. That's kind of a joke. But we all have blind spots, and you cannot see your own. So the idea of having an objective third party who can point them out to you has been worth its weight in gold.
When it's us, there's so much emotion involved in it. Mm-hmm. Well, of course we want to give our kids the best thing. Of course we want to, I don't know, buy whatever. To her, it's a number on a piece of paper. If you haven't figured out how that's going to work in that piece of paper, well, then you come up with a new plan. And I think that has been really, really helpful for us.
Mm-hmm.
Can I go backwards for a second on something?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So, you know, that I've wondered a lot about that polarity of freedom versus stability, the two sides.
That's something we've talked about a lot over our lives, because we've been very like fast, and not even fast and light, but we've moved a lot. We've moved around a lot. Like stability, nobody would describe our experience over the last 20 years as stable.
Right. And I was thinking, you know, if... So our situation when we moved to New Zealand was, it was a little unstable. We were meant to be building a house and we weren't building a house. The house we were renting was getting sold, where we were going to live. And that instability also created the best adventure that we had. It kind of forced a new, it didn't force it. It opened the opportunity to go do something that was amazing and crazy and wild with our kids. And it was super unstable.
Hmm.
And... stability is really nice. So it's like, how can you kind of, I guess I'm thinking like that moving sand. I think you have a quote by the Pember children,
Children.
Yes. Thank you. What's the quote?
Oh, just that I'll paraphrase. I've got it in front. I can find it, but I'll paraphrase. Like we long for stable ground beneath our feet. We've tried 1,000 places to hide and 1,000 ways to tie up all the loose ends, and yet the ground is still shifting beneath our feet.
Yeah. So then you kind of wonder, well, is it an illusion, that stability? Because the ground is always shifting, right? You put your stake in the ground, we have a house. Okay, well, something could change. Or that shifting ground also meant we went across the seas to a different land.
Yeah, it's so interesting because what we naturally do, we've had this conversation a lot on 50 Fires. What you naturally do is like, if I just had a little bit more, I'd finally be stable. Mm. If I just had a little bit more, I'd finally be secure. And the problem with that is, I know people with a little bit more. I know people with a lot more.
Sure.
In fact, one of the premises when we started working on the concept for the show, my partners Dave and Rebecca and I were talking about this idea of the Wizards of Enough. I mentioned that I was like searching for the Wizards of Enough because I've been on the search for a long time. Like, I want to meet people who have enough. And it was interesting to realize that it was harder for us to find a billionaire with enough than it was for us to find people that have almost nothing but have enough. Like, believe they live, they're a wizard of enough. They believe as they live as if they have enough. That's crazy. So more money does not solve that problem.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, Corey, what message do you hope our kids are getting from our relationship with money?
What message do I hope our kids are getting from our relationship with money?
The way our family handles money. And I'm using the word hope because I know that might be different than what we actually portrayed the last 25 years.
Yeah.
Maybe we start there. What do you think the message is that we actually portrayed for the last 25 years to our kids?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that we have always placed our highest value on time with family outside. And I don't think we've ever swayed from that value. Mm-hmm. So we have definitely put our money where we say our value is. We spend time with our kids in the mountains, in the rivers, on the ocean. So I think that our kids know that that is what we place our highest value on, and that we value being with them regardless. But I do think we've also given a message of, I think money's been a little stressful for them too, right? Because it's stressful between you and I think that they have, kids are smart. They pick up on that sense. So I know that they have felt some of that sense of stress.
Yeah. And what do you hope? You know, I feel like things have gotten much better and changed quite a bit over the last 6-7 years, New Zealand. Mm. Mm. What do you hope the message we're sending now is?
I like the idea that, like, hey, we've got you no matter what. We're your safety net. You let us be the wind in your wings to go fly and find out what you're really good at in this world. Mm. You know, if you need it, you always can come home. If you need a new pair of running shoes, we got you, right? I mean, simple things. And I think that our kids are doing that. I feel like where they all are, that we don't have a child that lives in the state of Utah. So we clearly taught them, head out, do your thing, have your adventure, figure out what's right. And I would hope that they would feel like, you know what? I have enough. Mm. My parents have enough. And I, with that enough, I have a freedom to go figure myself out, to figure out my career, my contribution to this world, my contribution to other people, communities, whatever it is.
Love you.
Mm, thanks. Love you too. Thanks for having the conversation.
It's the first time I've gotten to end the 50 Fighters conversation with I love you.
Oh, well, that's good news.
So I've had a couple weeks to reflect on that conversation that you just listened to with Corey and I. And there's a couple things I just want to share. One is that talking about money is hard. And it's hard because no one ever taught us how to do it. It's hard because, and I think if you can understand this one little piece, it becomes just a little bit easier. It's hard because we expect it to be a conversation about math. We expect it to be about spreadsheets and calculators. And then when we go to touch it, it's like an electric fence that we didn't know was electric. And I think we forget that. I know I forgot it over and over. I was surprised, like, whoa, wow, why are we fighting? I just opened the American Express bill. I just asked about the Amazon boxes. Why are we suddenly in? I mean, Corey used words like we would have arguments. I mean, these were fights, right? Like we used to tell the kids, that's called a heated discussion. but they were fights. Like, and why were we fighting? Because we both came from this background where we thought it was this supposed to be this rational, you know, 2 + 2 always equals 4. It doesn't matter how you feel about it. Suddenly we're feeling all sorts of things. And if we can remember that when we talk about money, we are talking about feelings. When I remember that, it goes a long way to having a better outcome in terms of my conversations about money. Now, the next thing I was thinking about is we don't really have a choice. And this came up a couple of times in our marriage, more than a couple of times, where money was at the center of some long simmering discussion that turned into an argument. And it never seemed to be at the center, but it was. Like when we peeled back, there was some other presenting problem. When we peeled it back, it was about money. And I remember thinking one time, well, I've got a choice. We have a choice. We can either keep trying, clumsy, lacking skill, we can either keep trying or we can stop having these conversations and either pretend just to be
two business partners living under the same roof or end our marriage. And clearly the better option, at least for us, has been to just keep trying and to grant ourselves. And this is one thing I really wanted to point out. We made a lot of mistakes and we talk about them openly here. And I am excited for my kids to, in fact, this, the first people I want to share this episode with are my kids. I'm excited for them to hear us work through the mistakes. And we point at mistakes, quote unquote mistakes, that our parents may have made. And I hope our parents feel the same way. The point of being parents is that we can learn from the mistakes they make and we can be a little better. So there's no shame or blame in not knowing how to talk about money. Most likely, no one taught you how to do it. That's why we're doing this podcast. It's the whole reason this podcast exists, is to start making conversations, meaningful conversations about money, normal. And the last thing that I thought about as I re-listened to this episode was the stories we tell and how fascinating it is that two people can have the same experience and see it dramatically different. It's so incredible how good we are at telling stories, thinking we're building on an objective set of facts and then layering on top of it the way we feel about it, and then layer on top of it the stories we tell about how we feel about the facts that we thought we saw. And then we come 28 years later to find out that that wasn't even really what happened, right? My wife and her experience with money wasn't about abundance and easy come, easy go, entrepreneurship. She's so comfortable with all that. It turns out that wasn't even what happened. And I've been repeating that story for years. So here's what I left feeling. Man, I really want to understand the people around me and their experience with money better. I'm so excited to talk to each one of my kids about their experience with money. I'm particularly excited about talking to them about what it was like in our family, what it was like living with me and money. What was it like living with mom and money? What's been your experience? I wonder if today, or maybe this weekend, or next time you're on a long road trip with your spouse or one of your kids, I wonder if that's a conversation worth having. Start with something simple. Something simple like, what was your first memory of money? And take it from there. Because that's the only way we're going to change this, is if we learn how to have these conversations with money. My friends, if you're listening to this when it first came out, it's at the end of the year. So as we head into the holiday season and all the feelings of new year, I love that this episode gives us something to talk about and something to think about as we try to improve our relationship with money in the new year. So once again, thanks for listening, and I'm so excited to see you around the fire in 2024. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio in association with The Roost. My friends, if you find this show valuable, share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 star review on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to larger audiences. I'm Carl Richards. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you around the fire for our next episode.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in the series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nil Audio, nor Magnolia.